Hello and welcome to the Film Ireland podcast. Today, in partnership with Access Cinema and the Japanese Film Festival, we are joined by a panel of very special guests to discuss Japanese cinema. I'd like to welcome Andrew Partridge, Stephen McNeice, and Emmy Shigeta. Thank you, everybody, for coming and chatting with us. It's so exciting ahead of such a cool festival that's planned, and it's great that it goes around the country as well. So thank you.
Pleasure.
No problem at all.
Thank you.
Great. So I'm going to go around this this fine Zoom room, and I'm going to get each of you just to say your name and then a description of your background in the industry. Super short, elevator pitch style. So I'll start with you, Stephen.
Yes, my name is Stephen McNeice. I work with Access Cinema and the Japanese Film Festival. I've kind of had a passion for Japanese film since I was a teenager, and I studied film in college, and that's actually when I first came in contact with the Japanese Film Festival here. And so for the last 6 or 7 years, I've been working with the festival, and in the last 2 or 3 years, I've joined Access Cinema full time, and this festival becomes a large part of my day job for a couple of months every year. So, yeah,
that's very exciting. And Access Cinema do such brilliant work, just making film more accessible in Ireland, which is so important, and really kind of like cultivating communities and not, you know, in those kind of classic regional hubs. I think you do brilliant work, so it's great to get to chat to you about it. So thank you so much. And Emmy.
Hi, nice to meet you. I'm Emmy Shigeta. I'm from Tokyo. I used to work in the distribution company in Tokyo, the name of the Uplink, and then I came to Dublin from 2018. Also, I used to work in the Lighthouse Cinema, so I met you, Stefan, last Japanese Film Festival.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then I'm making music now. Also, mainly I'm playing as a DJ in Dublin. So
brilliant. So creative and an understanding of the two industries and that background of working on the ground. So that's fabulous. Thank you so much. And Andrew.
I'm Andrew Partridge, and I started Anime Limited worryingly over 10 years ago now. But I've been working with the Japanese Film Festival in Ireland for longer than that now. I think about since 2010, 2011-ish, somewhere around there, like in another capacity when I was still a consultant for other companies for film, like the Japanese animated film. I've been working in the anime space for about 20, this will be the 20th year now, as of May. So that's worrying, to say the least. I've been doing this pretty much ever since I went to university. So it's been like in one capacity or another. Like, I started working for Bandai, the guys who ran Power Rangers, and then moved on to starting a film festival in Scotland, actually called Scotland Loves Anime, and then Anime Limited. So it's been quite a long journey on that frontier.
Wow. I'm just wondering if you guys could talk specifically about the festival in terms of reception. So you're working over in Scotland. Do you think like the tastes in our different kind of areas are different in terms of what we gravitate towards in anime, and that, you know, like say Ireland and Scotland as colonial countries, is there certain things we might resonate towards that other countries, maybe like France or England, might gravitate towards? I'm just curious to how the tastes might differ for regions.
I think regionally it's harder to pin down on it. Like, there's several, like, there's kind of like core titles in like the English speaking territories that resonate better than, say, France. Like Dragon Ball Z, for example, was kind of a big door opener in the English territories, whereas in France, Europe as a whole, there's several different titles. In France, it was titles like Grandizer and like City Hunter, for example, which were kind of on TV at the right time in teenagers and kids' lives, basically, like kind of 10-15 years before Pokemon in the UK, kind of like the UK and Ireland kind of like hit in, for example, which is kind of the first major dose of Japanese animation for a lot of young audiences, basically, at this point. Like, on it, it's true that there is very different taste between, say, the like Ireland, the UK, and the USA, for example. I mean, like, Ireland and the UK kind of go together on it, and there's a lot more appreciation for interestingly enough, it's more of an art house appreciation here in the US. I guess subtitled film is, it's not prevalent, but because of the spread of cinemas in the USA, there's less subtitled film available easily. It's only a more recent thing that films with subtitles, you know, Parasites and such, began to really blow that lid off in a really significant way in the US market, kind of in line with the Oscars and such. So you get film like TV series, for example, like Masaaki Yuasa's Tatami Galaxy, really worked nicely over here, whereas in the US, it was very much they only gave it a home video release like 2 years, 3 years ago max. Like, for example, it's kind of I'm saying for film as a whole, like the more, like less franchise films like A Silent Voice from Naoko Yamada really worked. Like it took off over here before the US had even released it theatrically. And that's really unusual because usually like the UK and Ireland they need the US uplift first for press to really maximize box office. But this, when it came out in kind of 2017, like it did a significant amount at the time for it, like with no real work from the US side, you know?
Wow.
And I think even within my time watching anime as a fan, as well as working in it, I think back in the 90s and early 2000s, a lot of the anime that was available would have been very, in the UK and Ireland, would have been very adult orientated. There was obviously, you know, things like Akira and Ghost in the Shell, but also, you know, a lot of sometimes very heavily cut anime from that was available via, I think Manga was the first company that really brought anime over here. But I feel, you know, again, this is just my own perspective, that something like Spirited Away felt like something of a turning point as well. Yeah. And kind of that opened the floodgates to Ghibli releases over here and things like that.
And Emmy, I might like your experience with Irish audiences as well, like dealing in the Lighthouse and through distribution. Would you notice like maybe even generationally a different hunger for different types of work?
The anime. I think so. Actually, yeah, I love the Japanese anime, but I'm surprised when I came to Dublin. So Irish people, of course, British people loves Japanese film, anime, mainly like, of course, Ghibli is very famous. Although, like, do you know Samurai Champloo?
Yep.
Actually, in Japan, it's very, very quiet. It's very underground movie, anime. But everyone's noticed here, so I'm surprised. I think a bit different audience, but I think Irish people, I mean, European people more knows underground Japanese anime.
Do you think as well it's that the audiences are sort of almost cultivated? So if you look at, like, I remember catching Spirited Away, but it was in a big chain cinema, which was amazing at the time. And then Stephen, Access Cinema do such brilliant work in, you know, like finding audiences and nurturing a hunger for these films in them. And again, like, these are all government incented schemes, like even our independent films cinemas here and in the UK, like they would be supported by the state. Do you think maybe that's some of the things that are missing from, like, maybe mainstream America, that these audiences are cultivated, or is it more a proximity, or is it because maybe we're such small countries, the natural tendency is to look outward in terms of art and voices and stuff? I'm just curious to what your opinion would be on that across the board.
I always think one of the big things is that, you know, in the States in particular, they don't have the same kind of robust arts funding that the UK, Ireland and Europe have. So, you know, it's purely commercialized in the States to a very large extent. And, you know, obviously, you know, things do need to succeed commercially over here as well. But I think there's more of a history there of kind of supporting art and non-commercial film, which I think feeds into. And I think, you know, obviously anime is in many ways the most commercial side of Japanese film these days. You know, it is hugely popular. But I think, you know, that's why we get a kind of broader range of films over here, I reckon, from Japan some of the times, is because there is that kind of, you know, culture of supporting different types of film. And I know it is challenging because obviously European film in particular has a lot of supports to get into cinemas over here that Japanese films and films from anywhere else in the world don't really have outside of Hollywood. But I do think there is just a general willingness there to take risks. And I know commercial cinemas have gotten a lot better in getting Japanese films in there. I know Andrew was involved in the release of Godzilla Minus One, for example,
Wow.
which has been a massive success in multiplex cinemas. And obviously anime as well, often now, and thanks to films like Your Name, Suzumi and many others, anime has now become a little bit more mainstream, I think, in multiplexes as well as the art house.
Yeah, I'd say that's fair on it. Like in terms of like in the US side as well, I think the problem is just accessibility as well. It's such a sprawling, one state in the US, basically, California is more than the size of the UK and Ireland together, basically on it effectively geographically, which is scary when you think about it in terms of scale. But when you think about the amount of cinemas there, it's kind of like the problem we like. I don't know how it is for Irish cinema as a whole, but like in the UK, a lot in the old days at least, everything centered around London, and like over time. Not just for Japanese animation and such, but like in general for cinema, there's this robust festival cut. Like the Japanese Film Festival is a really shining example of that, actually, to be honest, on it, where it's like festivals create accessibility, but not all of them have to happen in exactly the same place. And the Japanese Film Festival really goes like it'd be easy to just run it in Dublin, for example, but like the Japanese Film Festival makes that effort to be accessible wherever you are. It doesn't assume everyone is going to come to Dublin for that thing. For me, that's really important. As I say, in the UK as a whole, you have these incredible fair, like Africa Emotion in Edinburgh, for example, instead of in London, for example, focusing on like on Afro cinema, like as a whole, like they have the whole kind of diaspora across the board there on it. Like you have like social change festival, film festivals, like every kind of area of film you can imagine there is a festival for, and it's not all in London anymore, which was a common problem for all of us, like kind of unilaterally before, whether you were from Wales, Scotland, like Northern Ireland, Ireland, it doesn't matter. We were all pretty boned by it before on that frontier about 10, 15 years. It's a really recent change, actually, all in all. The one festival which has really been like to memory on the side, which has really championed going wider for so long, is the Japanese Film Festival, which is convenient given we're here on it to talk about it. But like it's true, like the work the Japanese Film Festival has done and Access Cinema as a whole is really a shining example of cinema outreach as a whole. It's something the US tries to, but you get this in the US, you get kind of two Londons basically, you get New York and you get LA. And if something should fall in between the two, that's a happenstance on it. But I've never yes, you get big film festivals in some of the other cities and such, like a lot of them have an international film festival, but there's nothing which digs deeper that is on an international level of recognition. And like that's like it's really tough. It's a victim of geography rather than a victim of lack of interest, I think, as well nowadays, when you look at where the Academy focuses interest, things like this year, Anatomy of a Fall, it didn't win the best foreign language film. It won in other cat like foreign film is now finally beginning to win, like in other categories, like on it, which is like something. If you told me again, if you told me 10 years ago that would happen, I'd been highly skeptical about it, And that's.
Or even the way we consume things. My mom and aunt are watching Korean soap operas on
Yeah.
Netflix. Like audiences are seeking things in a way that I have never seen people so hungry for like
Hungry
different
for
voices and different content in that
different
way as well.
contents.
And I think film festivals are a way to tap into a community and be part of it instead of it being such a of an insular experience. And I do think that's so wonderful. I was wondering, Emmy, if you could speak to maybe your experience of living in the two in the two like two different countries. And do you think like there's a different appreciation for the film as us looking at it as outsiders than maybe Japanese audiences might have sitting in cinemas waiting for their releases to come out?
So when I walk in the lighthouse cinema, like I supported the Japanese Film Festival last year. Like everyone's so cute crowds because everyone's put on the anime costume, some people, or like t-shirts or whatever. But in Japanese people, it's nothing. Like, you know, we are very shy, just like watching the movie. But like feeling like more Irish people, if they go to the cinema, like a party mood, and then everyone very respect to the Japanese culture, and everyone's very polite, very interesting for me, like compared to normal film or like Japanese anime or whatever Japanese film. The customer is very different vibes. It's very polite to Irish customer to watching the Japanese film. It's very interesting for me. And then like general Japanese customer in Tokyo watching the cinema, just like a cinema, not special mood. So I'm so happy to walk in the light of cinema to watching the Irish customer.
Like if you're back home, you're watching a film, it's just a film. And for us, it's so special. It's an experience, and it's a step into a new world that we wouldn't have as much experience with. And then you have people that love it so much and that respect it. So it's lovely to see that level of enthusiasm. And like partly I'm just interested in terms of funding for like Japanese cinema, like and maybe if it's different in anime, if we could flag that as well in terms of funding. But I'm just curious to how the ecosystem is set up in Japan and how films are sort of funded from the ground up, first of all.
Yeah, I can just, I think Andrew will be better equipped to speak about anime, but I know, you know, when you look at the box office charts from Japan, a lot of the films that would be top there are not films that would necessarily play very well with Irish or UK audiences. A lot of it would be things like television show spin-offs and very broad comedies and things like that. So there is, you know, there is very much a distinction between the mainstream and I think I don't know if independent is the right word to describe it, but, you know, the art house scene in Japan. So a lot of the films we'd be showing wouldn't necessarily be films that would be the biggest hits of the year. But I think anime is actually probably the exception to that in many ways, because I know we're showing things like The First Slam Dunk is showing as part of this year's festival in Dundalk. And that is, I think it's one of the biggest anime films ever in Japan and actually Asia more widely. So and things like obviously The Boy and the Heron more recently would have been a massive commercial hit in Japan as well. So I think anime reflects it, but I think, you know, the mainstream Japanese titles would not necessarily be the titles we're always showing. There'll always be some that will make it through. Again, some of the anime adaptations have done very well for the festival in the past, the live action adaptations of popular anime shows. But I think Andrew might be better equipped to talk about anime and specifically, you know, that.
And on both, it's in it, like the Japanese market's a really interesting one for cinema because it's predominantly driven by women. Like, actually, so a lot of there's a lot of special day, like, you know, for example, there's Women's Day for cinema in Japan where there's cheaper tickets if you are a woman, for example. Last time I was there, my wife took advantage out of a friend from Warner to go and see Perfect Blue, for example, because it was being re-released in 4K. So they went to go have a watch at that, basically, on that day. But so films are made and broken by, for example, the stars in it. So talking about TV dramas before and such, if their favorite actor or like actor is in the film, that's going to work well. But if there's a character that like a large amount of the female audience do not like, for example, for some reason or another, that film can suffer as a result. Both, and that applies to anime as well in terms of the voice actors as well and such. It's not like one-sided on it, but whereas the demographic for us might be more weighted, it's decreased nowadays. It's almost 50-50 on most films, a lot of anime films nowadays in the UK, in the islands. But the reality is that like it's very often, it can be 60-40 or such, whereas for certain types of film in Japan, it's completely the reverse.
So casting is like your number one consideration in terms of getting a
casting
project?
Like casting and type of project. I mean, for some anime, it's traditional male orientated, like content. This isn't some kind, it's not all revelationary stuff on it. It's just one quirk of the of Japanese theatrical releases, which isn't often encountered as that. For domestic release, at least, for international releases, it's, you know, a Marvel film is going to work basically to a greater or lesser extent, regardless, like, depending on how well it works internationally. It's like, it's not that it's a cookie cutter in every territory in the world, but it does, you know, that kind of, Dune 2, for example, is going to, if it does well in, like, in one territory, it'll do well in other, you know, there's some films which transcend basically domestic interest on it, you know, but like for local produced film, it's true that like what works internationally for live action may not be the same. That's only like Godzilla Minus One is a very rare exception where the message and the, because Godzilla Minus One is really more of an ecological and people film than it is a kaiju movie. It's like, it's really surprising in that sense. It's not like Godzilla is like an angry cat in it, basically, which is he's not ostensibly not deliberately evil, but he's also quite reasonably pissed off that he's been poked by the proverbial nuclear stick in this case, you know, a laser pointer on it. And it's a film which works in both territories, in both parts of it, like both domestically and internationally, because there's something in it that is really, it ticks boxes for both the fans of like Godzilla already and people who are fans of people drama, war drama and such, or anti-war drama as the case is. On the flip side, bizarrely, and this one always confused me, although I shan't complain as a distributor, both the weird alt, like the kind of the weird situation where both the alt-right and the far left were both keen on the film. On the alt-right side, they're like, yes, I can see finally a film about wokeness in it. I'm like, did I watch the same movie in this? Like, on it, because it covers some pretty sensitive social and like geographical issues in it in a quite a delicate and considered way on it. And like on the other side, like I don't know what everyone was deriving from it. It somehow it transcended that barrier which normally exists, especially like in current climate on stuff. It's which was honestly a big surprise. That's not something we could have factored in on it. It's not something we were worried about either on it per se. You'd like a film finds its audience one way or another on it. Normally you just accept it's not, most films are not a film for everyone on it, but they seem to have something in it for everyone. And so, you know, some films do transcend that boundary the other direction as well, like on it. And it's really interesting on it. It's interestingly enough though, like on global distribution, anime adaptations of live action can go one way or the other on that scale very quickly. It's like, you know, for every one really strong one, like Golden Kamuy looks like it's going to be fantastic, for example, coming up. Like you get one or two Black Butler style movies, which inherently work for Japan and cater to that audience, but then don't resonate theatrically when it happens, you know?
That's sort of interesting in terms of, like, again, it's more like audience cultivation and who's watching what. Like you were saying, like about tastes being different, does that sort of feed into the taste? Because I have noticed as well, like pacing is very different. Like the time spent with characters is a lot more. And I'm just wondering, is that sort of like, would that be an appropriate acknowledgement, or is that just, you know, like the kind of the surface level, and is there really something a lot deeper going on? I'm just wondering your own opinions on that.
Taste does come into it a bit. I think since a lot of Japanese film for a long time has been over, like in our term, like in what we would look at, it's over the runtime we would normally look at in a film.
It's always fun when programming the festival, I must say.
Yeah, it's a programmer's nightmare always on it. It's like, and it's like, there's lots of different reasons for it. Like, I don't think there's just one specific reason. Sometimes it's like when you're adapting something from a comic book or such, either you take creative liberties, which you see often in like Marvel. Like, I don't think like Marvel has to kind of craft its own way with things. If you followed the comics ad verbatim, you'd have some really weird and problematic stuff at times. But like adapting content in Japan can be not always, but like it can be more difficult because the rights holders are more often stricter in the sense of once you bought the rights, it's not yours to do with as you please, even in the West on it. But like there's a lot more control. So Blue Giant, which is screening during the festival this year, for example, is a fascinating case of that. So basically they initially, you know, they talked among themselves, the creator, the director and producers all talked among themselves, like, we want to make this. And like they were planning for it to be a TV series, actually, on it. And then the publisher came back and said, we like your pitch, but you pitched it to us as a film, so a film it has to be. We really, really like the film concept. And they were like, well, like, oh no, like basically we're gonna have to that. Sorry, my Glaswegian tendency to swear. I'm having,
oh no, that's fine. It's a podcast, so unless Access Cinema have
sent. In which case they said, oh fuck, we have to sort this out basically. Because we're now boxed into this. We have something which is 10 really chunky volumes of manga about this amazing jazz performer, but like the trouble is with it is the first part of the story doesn't really work as a film. But that is the part where you gain an appreciation for the main character Dai in it, like Paul Dai. And he's like, he's this really interesting guy, like, really determined. He's really a skilled musician and he's going to go somewhere in the world. But the first arc of that manga is the one where they introduce him and you kind of fall in love with him. The second arc is all about a pianist, like a jazz pianist and such, really more. And like, Dai's character isn't developed so much during that. So he comes across as a bit of an ass, to be honest, in it half the time. And like he's probably the least relatable of the trio in it during the film on it. But like it's still a passionate like piece that you have to work out. You've got the situation where you've got a max of like, in theory, if you were running on UK time, like kind of UK and like Western cinema times, basically as a whole for film. You've got 90 to 120 minutes to tell this story, and what do you? And they kept constrained within that, but like, what story do you tell? How do you tell it? And the trouble is, very often, what you see in this situation when you are constrained by these kind of restraints is people going, "Well, if I just work the story, the time a little bit, what if we make it 180 minutes instead of 120 minutes? What can we tell the whole story then?" And sometimes. Sometimes that's an imperative from the rights holder. Sometimes it's a directorial choice. I don't think there's one cultural reason. I think it's just every director has to and producer has to work with some challenges in every country in the world. I mean, it's not easy being a producer or a director, basically, like on it. But like, I think in Japan, the sets of challenges they face push them often towards that question of, can we make this a longer run film? But it can be self-sabotaging. There's films out there which were 100% aimed at children, which are like 100 to 120 minutes long, which makes it absolutely impossible, at least in the Western world, to sell to families. But even in Japan, it's hard to get a kid. Like the same tenet basically remains across the world. If it's over 90 minutes long, it's really difficult to get a kid to sit through it normally under a certain age. And above a certain age, it has to be really, really good to get them to hang around for it. You know, you look at all the Studio Ghibli movies and such, for example, as a baseline. They know who their audience is, and they work around that in terms of interest. Like, and some films, however, do not do that often when they're adapting source material. Sometimes not, but like often when adapting it. So that's. It can be quite a challenge when you're told, if you meet a distributor and they're like, this is a film for children. And you're like, how long's the runtime? Oh, 120 minutes. And you're like, I see.
I want to talk maybe about some important shifts that happened in Japanese cinema. And I'm just wondering, like, if there was like a moment for you where you could see things that were really changing in Japanese cinema or maybe a moment that was really important to you. So, Emmy, I was wondering, could you say that? Like, what was, say, a moment in Japanese cinema that really, like, made you so passionate and excited?
Essentially, I love the documentary about Have you watched Ryuichi Sakamoto's opus? That's, like, so amazing. Oh, yeah, Koda Hajime. Yeah, Koda Hajime. That's so very interesting and inspired of the music, of course, and the shooting as well.
I know, since Sakamoto we have a double bill at this year's festival. I don't know, Emmy, if you could think about how Sakamoto's presence in Japan, what kind of figure he is over there.
Because of course he's very famous, but like currently our age, because I do Sakamoto's music, it's my mom's age's music. So I know the name, but not often listen to the music. But when I watch the movie, that's very amazing. Also, I didn't know like that's Western cool. people loves Ryuichi Sakamoto and YMO as well. So actually I'm DJing here. Mainly I put on the Japanese city pop music. So I surprised because like a teenager loves to the Ryuichi Sakamoto music as well in here. I think it's mainly, sorry, a bit change subject, because I guess everyone's catch up the music from TikTok. So I really surprised everyone noticed Ryuichi Sakamoto, YMO music, younger people. So I mean, it's very surprised. It's I'm very digging his career, digging his music now. But Western people is much knows about his music, his movie as well. That's surprise to compare to.
I know I was actually doing another interview yesterday and the presenters pointed out how much they loved Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence and the music from that. So I think a lot of Japanese people I've spoken to are surprised how well Sakamoto is known outside of Japan. So it's great to be able to actually mark his passing this year with that double bill.
And I'm just wondering as well, is there any sort of movements? Has there been any shifts in the industry that you were saying, like again, even documentary? Yes, I haven't seen any of that. Is there, you know, like leanings or times when where you know you can see slight changes in what's being produced and why?
I think so. Yeah, having done this for a couple of years now, it's kind of been interesting seeing particular films breakthrough for whatever reason and kind of seeing what results of that. I know quite a few years ago now we showed Happy Hour, which is kind of the first, it was kind of on the festival scene, it was the first breakthrough of Hamaguchi, who then went on to do obviously Drive My Car, which is a massive, massive success. And obviously kind of like Parasite and Anatomy of a Fall had success beyond just the kind of art house circuit and was like Oscar nominated and everything like that. So it's been kind of great seeing, kind of giving Happy Hour, which is what, 5.5 hours? So it's a very long film. It's a brilliant film. But it was great giving that a launch pad, and then over the subsequent years being able to actually launch films like Drive My Car for a much bigger audience, who as he became better and better known. It's also been great, actually. One kind of trend I've been very happy to see, and it's kind of reflected in this year's program, is I think from a couple of years ago, One Cut of the Dead, which is a very, very funny kind of zombie comedy, which has several twists which completely upend the film. But I think that kind of trend it's a very small film as well, very low budget. And I think over the last couple of years, pretty much every year we've programmed a similarly kind of low budget, lighthearted comedy, usually kind of, you know, 80, 90 minutes maximum, which has some kind of nice, fun genre twist. Kind of Mondays is the film we're showing this year, which is a very funny time loop comedy. And there was Beyond the Infinite, what was it, Beyond the Infinite 1 minute or 2 minutes? From a couple of years ago, which is another absolutely delightful film. So it's been great to have those crowd-pleasing indie comedies as well. And even on anime, I think we've seen, you know, you do see a shift as well in kind of, you know, what audiences. Your Name was a massive one. I think that really expanded the type of film that does well with audiences. And it's been, like, on a personal level, it's been great to see films like Our Sound from a few years ago, which we were delighted to launch at the festival because it's such a creative just burst of energy. It's a musical, it's kind of a film about a band a kind of high school band, but every performance scene is filmed in a very exciting, interesting way. And another kind of just on a stylistic note as well, I think we're finally getting to the point when we're seeing 3D animation kind of used very, very effectively in a lot of anime. I think the first Slam Dunk is a brilliant example of that. Blue Giant is a brilliant example of that. The performance and performance scenes in Blue Giant are by far the highlight of the film. I think it's fair to say they're just incredibly filmed. And same with the first Slam Dunk, the actual basketball games, the way they're filmed has this kind of energy. And I would have been very cynical about the use of 3D animation in a lot of anime. I'm a bit of a purist when it comes to hand-drawn anime, but it's been great to see computer generated stuff used in a creative way rather than just as a cost saving measure.
And Andrew, what about specifically for anime? What are the sort of shifts that you're, because you, I mean, you're on the ground in terms of watching everything that's coming through the ranks. I'm just curious to, do you notice, like, has, say, even say, I do think there was a sort of conscious shift post-COVID, and you know, like, there's people processing what that meant, and you know, there's the next generation coming up, and like, ecological issues. Do you know, like, I'm just wondering, what are the trends and kind of like key changes that you're watching on the ground?
I mean, from an industry point of view, the industry works in cycles. So basically, you know, for a long time after Your Name came out, everyone had the next Makoto, like film like Your Name. It's this director's the next Makoto Shinkai. You know, that would be on my bingo card for the times I went to meetings, basically, to see how many times it came up. And like, which in a way is it's really reductive as well, because like each director is different. So it's like, you know, you can't. Yes, you can compare like Mamoru Hosoda to Shinkai to Naoki Yamada, but like it's reductive because each of their styles are very unique and different, and their messages are different. Like, so it's like it's basically just like saying, oh, this will be the next blockbuster. But the biggest shift really is kind of COVID driven in a way, accidentally on it, which is how do you revitalize the cinema and people coming back to the cinema in a real way. And that really came from franchise film. So the biggest seismic change in the industry for Japanese animation in the last, I'd say the last 5 years, post-COVID anyway, or like mid-COVID to post-COVID, is Demon Slayer Mugen Train. Like Demon Slayer Yaiba Mugen Train. Basically, it was the first time in a long, long time where, so you get these franchise films as part of long-running series. So you'll get like My Hero Academia, Dragon Ball Z, and for example, and such, which have them, where you know you've had a 26 episode run of a show, there's a gap before the next season airs, and so they would come up with these films which are normally an original story because they don't have the time to adapt something in the middle, and they need something to keep going while often while the manga artist was drawing more of a comic to keep them going, basically. That's basically what's happened with My Hero Academia, for example. So these would be original stories, either due to the fact that the artist didn't want any of their arcs adapted into a film, or quite simply, there wasn't enough material. This was to buy time while keeping the title, the engine running on the franchise, basically, for it to keep people interested. But with Demon Slayer Mugen Train, if you wanted to know what happened next first, and like, or you wanted to see it first, you had to go to the cinema. So going back to what you were talking about before with how kind of the premiere event stuff in TV is kind of really transformed now due to the streamers and such, which is very, very true on it. It's the film kind of has brought us back the other direction. So basically, there's a reason. I mean, don't get me wrong, these films are very high production budget, they're very good quality. But one of the reasons that they are so big box office items internationally as well is because you bloody have to go to see it. You don't go and see it, like, you're going to be waiting for a long time for it to pop up on streamers while all your mates are talking about what's happened in it or how cool the animation was in that scene where you liked that you liked in the manga. It's like, but it also like it means that like any impact internationally on this is multiplied domestically in Japan, which means that the young audiences started coming back, like, to cinema because you had to know what happens next, with like to follow the series next and things like you just to see your favorite characters animated. The only way to do it was the big screen. And in the West, there is a traditional pattern of how long it takes to come to streaming. But you could in Japan, you know, the first Slam Dunk, for example, if you're a fan of a manga and you're like, nah, I'm just gonna wait for it to come to Netflix or whatever, over 18 months from theatrical release to streaming in Japan for that film. You know, the theatrical kept on going, which meant that the release date for streaming was reset until that run was complete. So it really, that was the biggest industrial shift in the last few years. And you look at it, like, there's a pattern. I mean, you look at films like that, Jujutsu Kaisen Zero, also canonically important. It's a prequel to the series, but if you don't watch it, you have no idea who some of the characters later are because they don't introduce them to you. So, like, they will appear and you're expected to know who they are, or you're missing a chunk out of the experience. Like, you're not going to be able to get as excited if you've not read the manga, because you're like, I have no idea who these people are. He's got a cool sword. Fantastic. I have no idea what he's doing here. And that was, like, that was a big shift. So you get things like, you know, Spy Family, the movie coming up, like a shameless plug on our part for April 26th. But the fact that, like, that's an interesting case because it's an original film still, but because the series kind of clusters around really, like, you watch it because it's more like a Sunday, like a Saturday morning cartoon, like, on it. It's very, even though there is an overarching plot, basically, throughout, you're there for the characters and their interactions. It's a very sweet, heartwarming title. It's from the same publication as Demon Slayer Yaiba, like, the same part, like, you know, Demon Slayer Yaiba, Jujutsu Kaisen, like, One Piece, etc., Naruto. But it's so tonally and thematically different. It's about family, it's about a young girl's kind of, like, who's an ESP, like, kind of adventures, like, with his fake family, basically. And it's a bit, like, that kind of title also gels, because it's, if it's just the same content with a higher production budget as a film, it's compelling to the same audience to go out. On the flip side of it, like, you know, if you need to know what happens next, the box office follows with it, basically, on. So I wouldn't doubt for a second that the Chainsaw Man movie, whenever it comes out, like, that's going to do very well as well, because they're adapting an arc within the manga. So it's like, you know, you want to see your favorite arc animated, or the next big arc, off to the cinema with you. And that's the seismic change, I would say, industrially. Like, personally, it's not my, like, it's not on my favorite film. I enjoy it. Like, I like Demon Slayer series. It's very entertaining. But as a movie, for me, it was like, well, this could have also been a TV series, you know? And it was. Like, they adapted it into a TV series afterwards. So you can, in fact, with these kind of franchise things, have your pie and also eat it twice, basically, on it. It's like, it's quite impressive as an idea.
And just when we're talking about developing IP and projects, I'd love to chat about The Lonely Castle in the Mirror. Can you tell me a bit about this title? Like, that's available to watch as part of the festival. It was developed on a novel, and then was it developed into a film and then into a manga series, or was it, what was the life cycle of it?
I think the manga came off because the novel is very, very well acclaimed. It's a really good novel, actually. I really recommend.
And I've been very surprised as we've been promoting the film. An awful lot of people have read the book, so it's proven one of the most popular titles of the festival for that reason.
The book is really, really good. Order the film, because this is again how you adapt with constraints. But when you're like someone like Keiji Hara is really smart about what he does with that kind of thing. So the story itself is about these teenagers who are, like, without spoiling anything, they all have their struggles in this. Like, bullying is a very serious issue internationally still, and in Japan, doubly so. And it's a situation Keiji Hara really cares about himself on that. So adapting, like, in the book, though, you have obviously a lot more pages to work with. So in the film, you're focused on one character out of the group, basically, and from her perspective, everything. So you get these kind of little visionettes of what's tormenting these other people in their lives at school. But you, like, it's all really centered around this one main character. Whereas in the books, you get a really deep dive insight into each of the characters. So, like, it's one of those situations, sometimes that can leave you with one work is poorer than the other. But in reality, honestly, for me, like, I hadn't read the book beforehand, before seeing it, but I went to read the book afterwards because I felt like I was going to get something different out of it. And I really enjoyed both experiences. I'd be really interested to hear after the festival, Stephen, how people who've read the book first feel about the film, because I like it was a strong contender in things like Scotland Loves Anime for awards. It was narrowly pipped at the post by Blue Giant for the Audience Award, for example. But it's like it's a really interesting film on it, and like I think I'll be curious to see how people react. It is very sensitive. It does approach things in a way that blends fantasy and real life problems together in a very subtle and real way, I think.
And I think it's, you know, it's a good example of how anime, you know, in many ways wears its heart on its sleeve in a way that a lot of, in a different way to what you kind of get in Western animation, I think, because it's very rare to see a Western animation that isn't specifically aimed at children, even films like, you know, Turning Red, which I think is an excellent film, but it's very much, you know, it's a bit more limited in what I can talk about just because it's aimed at a very wide audience rather than just teenagers specifically. Whereas I think Lonely Castle in the Mirror is more kind of, you know, focused on the teenage experiences in a more kind of blunt and kind of, you know, open way. So I think that will really appeal to a lot of audiences. And I think it's just, you know, it's a very beautifully drawn film. I think there's, you know, it's that perfect mix of fantasy and you know, teenage drama and coming of age drama that I think works really, really well. It's the kind of film that can only really come from Japan and anime, which is great. And I think it's a perfect example of the form. And it's kind of, you know, it's different as well to what you might expect from a Ghibli film or something like Demon Train. It's that kind of other strand of anime, which I think, you know, I'm not going to say it's the next Shinkai or anything like that, because that's not going to use that cliche, but I think it just shows that range of films, not kind of, you know, slice of life is a very big genre in Japan of you know, people actually trying to, you know, capture some of the true teenage experience and just mix with the kind of interesting, intriguing fantasy element of it just creates a very nice, potent mix. Brilliant. I think.
Right, top picks for the festival, everybody, if you want to get them ready. Stephen, you know it inside and out. So you can start. You can start with top pick.
Yeah, so I think I think Mondays is a great film. Is a very easy recommendation for people. I think that's great fun. As ever, we like, you know, there's dramas here that I think, you know, should play widely. Things like Egoist and Ripples and films like that. Personal favorite would be Typhoon Club, which is a classic film that we're actually bringing to the cinema. I think Shinji Shomai is a major, major director who's just waiting to be rediscovered by a mass audience. He deserves to be up there with all the great Japanese filmmakers. So if you haven't seen Typhoon Club, this is a great opportunity to see it.
And Andrew, is Lonely Castle in the Mirror, is that your topic, or is there anything that, like, outside of like that you'd be like, okay, well, I begrudgingly wouldn't mind seeing that?
I'm incredibly biased on this. So Blue Giant, yeah. Blue Giant is actually my choice. Like, we have Blue Giant and Lonely Castle in their hands. But that'd be a few anime films from us in there. Like, but like, I think for me, Blue Giant is the one for personal, like, personally, I would recommend to people. It's like, it's something you don't get very often, even in slice of life film from Japanese animation, because it is about jazz. It's about, like, these are people as well. Bear in mind that the director, there's some producers, they hadn't really listened to jazz commonly as fans beforehand. And you wouldn't guess from watching it. It really conveys the beauty of making music and the struggles people face in it. It's incredibly low stakes for a lot of the time, yet you feel really engaged with their desire to grow. It's from a really talented director, like Yuzuru Tachikawa is probably one of my favorite directors for TV series. He directed things like Death Parade, Mob Psycho 100, people probably know him better for, but Death Parade and Death Billiards. Death Billiards, to me, was a short piece made for like a Japanese government funding program for new animators and new directors and new talent as a whole. They were 20 minutes long and it didn't guarantee you were going to make something from it, but this short was so good. Madhouse adapted it and made a full TV series with the director. And it's a show about the purgatory and the afterlife and such on it, and kind of how do you judge what people are in it and such. It's a really fascinating kind of, it's a thriller more than anything, and it's really well contained. So it doesn't, like, the mystery of it and the subject, again, good sci-fi and good thriller, like, kind of fantasy thriller like that is defined by how much you can poke into the hole and like poke holes in it. And it's very hard to do when you keep it contained. So as a director, he's really skilled at original. This proves he's great at adapting work as well. Mob Psycho did that as well, but this, it really demonstrates the craft like on it, because it's tough to convey the jazz, and there's a story behind it all. Like the how they had to do, you know, the constraints they had on how they represented jazz filtered into how that kind of abstract, they do an really cool abstract style to represent the jazz when it's being played. And like that is a constraint put upon them by the publishers as well, but they really rock it. Like, you wouldn't guess it's a constraint. You would think it was a like 100% without any constraint, the choice on it. And like, a really skilled director like that can work with those constraints and kind of build something that is really their own in it. And I think Blue Giant stands out. So if you like music, if you like anime, like honestly, if you just like interpersonal drama, Blue Giant is the one I would Lonely Castle in the Mirror is a fantastic choice as well, to be very clear. Like it's more of what I would call a kind of a traditional anime adventure film and such on it. So like I'm recommending the one I'm worried people will ignore, like on it. And like Lonely Castle in the Mirror deserves every single seat to be filled as well. And like Keiichi Hara is a master, as much of a master as people like Shinkai, Hosoda, Yuasa, and Yamada, like all of them are, he's in the same camp. Like he directs some really sensitive films before about topics, similar topic, you know, tough topics like bullying, suicide, yeah, and the beauty of art separately. You know, he directed a film about Hokusai, like fictionally Hokusai's daughter, based on like called Miss Hokusai, like Here Comes Miss Modern on it. And it's, you know, that's a fascinating shift from things like Colorful, which is about like some very dark topics as well. You know, he's done his share. He kind of fluctuates between light and dark in film. So like if you're looking for something that you traditionally recognize as anime, Lonely Castle, like, and you will get an amazing experience out of Lonely Castle Mirror, is full of everything you want. It's got characters you can engage with, twists, turns, and like honestly some plot twists that you will sit through the film in that and think, I think I know what's going to happen next, and you will eventually form a picture of what's going to happen, but almost certainly the first few thoughts you have are going to be wrong. Like, I asked it, like, everyone at the jury screening of Scott and Los Angeles what their first thoughts about it were. None of us had the correct art. We all got it before the end of the film, but, like, the joy of Lonely Castle Mirror in part is you're actively there trying to work out the mystery as you go as well. And you will, like, you will figure it out probably during it. And if not, just enjoy the film and they will reveal it to you. This isn't a film like... It's not Inception where you're left questioning what really was the end. They will tell you what the ending is on it, like in due course. But part of the fun for me at least was figuring out what's going on throughout. And it's a very satisfying film from that point of view too.
And Emmy, your top picks?
I'm very excited to watch the Shinya Tsukamoto's. Actually, I don't know the English name. Stefan, do you know?
Shadow of Fire.
Yes. So Japanese title is Hokage. So I'm very excited. I haven't watched it yet, but the movie showing to Japan, I guess last year, everyone's amazing. They said it. And I saw that on Twitter yesterday. The X. I think he got to the some of Japanese film award yesterday. The film, it looks amazing. If you like Godzilla, I guess you like his movie taste, because his first movie, the name Tetsuo. Sorry, English name is...
Yeah, it's Tetsuo. Tetsuo, the Iron Man. Yeah.
It's very type of similar as Godzilla, but his currently movie is totally changing his taste. More, he making war story. Like 1916, 1970s movie. It's very depressed, very sad film, but very important things to show to the another country as well, because I guess everyone doesn't know it's very depressed Japanese situation, 16 era. And then, what's a Hokage? Fire on...
Shadow of Fire.
Shadow of Fire, yeah. Exactly. I guess super depressed movie, but looks.
And we've been lucky enough to show it's part of a trilogy, Shadow of Fire, a kind of loosely connected thematic trilogy. And we've been lucky enough to show the previous films from Tsukamoto as well, Killing and Fires on the Plain. And I know I was talking to Emmy last year and she was so excited about Tsukamoto's new film. So we're very excited we're actually able to include it in this year's festival.
And it is, it's a very powerful film. Emmy, I wonder, how do you feel about gender equality behind the camera in Japanese cinema?
Yeah, I think that the film industry seems to have a lot of women active recently. Many filmmakers have entered the industry as well. And more than half of the staff, like I used to work in the Uplink, I remember definitely it's mainly the women's working there.
We do. We're lucky to have some films from female directors this year. It's always a big festival, a big focus of the festival. So films like Ripples and Remembering Every Night and a few others this year are all from women directors. So we're always delighted to include those.
I think it's changing in animation as well. It's like the trouble of change is it takes time. And like it's taking too long in many ways on it. But you have directors and screenwriters like, I mean, Reiko Yoshida, who's written scripts like, you know, Silent Voices, the one, and K-On!, which leap to mind immediately, but she's prolific. You're screening Lonely Castle Mirror, which has a female screenwriter, like award-winning screenwriter attached to Maros. Like,
And Andrew, of course, is instrumental in getting Mario Kada over to Dublin a few years ago as well. Whose latest film has just launched on Netflix within the last couple of months. So,
Alison Therese's Illusory Factory, which I always think of Arrested Development when I hear that. I think Michael, but Mario Kada, Naoki Yamada as well is right up there with, you know, she's like creatively is exactly in the same level as people like Shinkai-san, Asoda-san, etc. in terms of talent, but creates a very different type of film, more from like from just lived experiences as a director, like are going to be inherently different if you're a woman versus a man in the Japanese animation space. Not necessarily deliberately to be abundantly clear on it, but it's natural. Even like, I mean, hashtag not all male like cinema perspectives are the same, for example. So it's reasonable to assume that there's going to be another shift in spectrum. And I can't wait to see what there's more young or upcoming female directors where I can't wait to see what they make as a film. Like Rie Matsumoto, for example, who directed, like one of my favorite anime in recent years, a Blood Blockade Battlefront season one, for example, where you get, like, there's just a kind of vividness to the work. It's not, again, this is not one, there's not one cookie cutter directorial view, but it's really interesting to see the variations you're getting from that. Saya Yamamoto, for example, Need We Forget Yuri on Ice, a film, like, series which, you know, like, wouldn't happen without her as a director. Like, she's, like, truly a visionary in a lot of senses on it. And, like, you know, who knows if the Yuri on Ice movie will ever happen on it, based on interviews and such. It's not looking too hopeful, but I can't wait to see what she makes as a director next, you know? And there's a lot of like that as well. So Kotomi Deai, for example, in the directorial space, who's just finished a TV series called Skip and Loafer, which I would also recommend to anyone who wants to see something a little different on it, but also a really interesting TV series, an original series called Rolling Girls, which is about a post-apocalyptic world with roller derby characters from different areas of Japan. It's surreal, but it's really interesting as a piece. And you get, so it's beginning to happen over time, but this is like drops in the water versus the overall talent. It's still overwhelmingly male to female ratios in balance, but slowly but surely that's changing. It's like it's going to take a lot longer though to say it's really happened.
So thank you for joining us, and thank you for listening. If you want to catch more podcasts, make sure to like and give us a follow, and you can subscribe to the Film Ireland newsletter now on filmireland.ie.